Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, this is Nathan Moore, your host on the New Books Network. Today, we will be interviewing Julia F. Irwin about her new release, Catastrophic Diplomacy, U.S. Foreign Disaster Assistance in the American Century, out of the University of North Carolina Press. Welcome to the network, Julia.
Thanks very much for having me. I'm looking forward to the conversation, Nathan.
What is your academic background? I see that you attended Yale, and where are you now?
I went to Oberlin College, graduated there in 2004, and then earned my PhD from Yale in both history and the history of medicine and science. And from there, I graduated in 2009 and then got a job teaching at the University of South Florida, where I taught from 2010 to 2013. Just this year, though, I moved to Louisiana State University, where I am now teaching as a professor.
And Catastrophic Diplomacy, is this your first or second writing book? And how does it relate to your past or future research?
Yeah, so this is my second monograph, Catastrophic Diplomacy. So my first book was called Making the World Safe, The American Red Cross and the Nation's Humanitarian Awakening. That book was my doctoral dissertation that got revised into my first book. And in that book, I studied the history of U.S. humanitarian aid during the First World War era. So that book was mostly focused on war and wartime, but in writing it, I became really interested. I kept seeing sort of in the archives and my records examples of U.S. responses to disasters caused by earthquakes, hurricanes, floods, sort of other natural hazards. So when I finished that book, it came out in 2013, I started turning my attention to disaster studies and became kind of interested in the politics of these peacetime humanitarian operations. So that's where Catastrophic Diplomacy began, was kind of what was left on the cutting room floor of my first book, I think.
Can you provide a brief overview for the New Books Network of the main themes and arguments presented in Catastrophic Diplomacy?
Yes. So in this book, I'm examining the history and really the politics and the diplomacy of U.S. foreign disaster assistance. So this is American disaster aid to other nations and other empires throughout much of the 20th century. The book starts in the early 20th century and kind of winds its way through the mid 20th century up to the 60s and into the early 70s, where I really stop. In the book, I'm interested in a few different themes. One of them is kind of looking at a much longer history of U.S. governmental involvement in foreign aid. A lot of the focus is on both the government, especially the U.S. State Department and various diplomats and consuls, as well as the U.S. military and the role that they have long played in U.S. humanitarian assistance earlier than we often imagine. I'm also interested just in the ways that natural hazards and events, so things like earthquakes, hurricanes, flash floods, have shaped the histories of U.S. foreign relations in ways that we don't always think about or see in different regions, different parts of the world. So this is kind of a lot of the book is kind of thinking about how these sudden events and the emergency responses to them have affected U.S. diplomacy and foreign relations with different countries and different regions in different moments throughout time.
What motivated you to explore the topic of U.S. foreign disaster assistance throughout the so-called American century?
Yeah. So I said earlier, my first book, I kept seeing all of these examples, and I wrote a little bit about a few of these disasters in my first book. But I was very interested in how these events that we often think about as unpredictable emergencies or catastrophes, how they draw in U.S. policymakers and what are the kind of political implications of these responses. So I had found this sort of in the archives for the early 20th century when I was writing my first book, and I wanted to know more. I wanted to know how how disasters over time have informed and influenced U.S. relations with other places. I wanted to know more about the role that the environment plays in shaping U.S. foreign policy. Certainly today in the 21st century, we are witnessing the effects of climate change and the disasters that it is contributing to. So I wanted to know about the longer history of climate-caused disasters as well as other other disasters, and think about how they had played a role in U.S. foreign relations before before climate change became the sort of issue that it is certainly today in the 21st century.
What was your research process like for this book, and were there any challenges in accessing historical data or sources?
That's a great question. So, I started this project, and I tried to cast a really wide net. I wasn't sure exactly where I wanted to finish the book, start the book. So I did a lot of research, kind of starting in the 19th century and really going up all the way to the end of the Cold War. It took me to the National Archives in the U.S., as well as I think I've been to now 12 different presidential libraries, maybe 13. I lost count. But then also international records. I spent a lot of time in Geneva researching in the records of the what was called the League of Red Cross Societies. It's the branch of the Red Cross Societies that the International Red Cross movement that deals with disasters and sort of peacetime crises. Other archives, including the Food and Agriculture Organization in Rome, which is a UN agency, the British National Archives outside of London. So kind of trying to get perspectives that weren't just from the United States itself. This is a project that looks at the U.S. responding to disasters in all parts of the world, in essentially on every continent except for Antarctica. So some of the challenges, right, are, how do you tell this kind of broad international global history? That it was impossible essentially to go to all of the places that I was researching, telling the stories about. So part of the ways that I tried to tell those stories were through the records of international organizations like the League of Red Cross Societies, give perspectives from different national organizations and people who were the recipients of USAID, trying to get kind of their perspectives and ideas as well. So that was certainly one of the challenges. One of the benefits of writing about disasters was kind of finding fortuitously in the U.S. National Archives the ways that diplomats had kind of classified these events. Made them fairly easy to find. There's actually a decimal number that they use to categorize disasters, which I discovered thanks to some very helpful archivist about a decade ago. But it made it possible for me to kind of go in and pinpoint, knowing when specific disasters happened. I could just call the records related to it. So that was a really a lucky finding. Was thanks to archival organization, made it possible to find a lot of records more easily than I might have.
Are there specific historical events that prompted the need for a comprehensive examination of U.S. foreign disaster assistance?
This book started, it took a while to work, to finish, to write. But when I was finishing my dissertation and kind of beginning, when I was on the job market the first time in 2010, in early 2010 was the Haitian earthquake, the major earthquake that struck Haiti in January 2010. And that event, I remember at the time being really struck by it, and kind of that was another kind of a current event at the time, at least, that did make me interested in the longer history of this, especially as it unfolded. We often think of disasters as something that happened in an instant and then are over. But certainly the U.S. response was years in the making. It followed relief, recovery, reconstruction efforts, but then also the ways, the roles that corporations and various philanthropies and charities played in intervening in Haiti. So kind of watching that unfold made me interested in the historical precursors to this, how comparable was this to what had happened in the 20th century? What was new? What was different? So that was one event that made me very interested. Shortly thereafter was the Fukushima disaster in Japan, The tsunami the 311 tsunami that hit Japan. So different events like these kind of, as I was beginning the project, made me more and more interested in, in this kind of international history of U.S. aid and disaster response.
How has the role of foreign disaster assistance evolved since the first years that you researched?
That's a great question. So as I mentioned earlier in the podcast, one of the things that really struck me about this research was the role that the federal government has played and the military have played in disaster assistance really since the early 20th century, and in some ways, in some places, even before that. But over time, so part of the book is trying to call attention to the role that the government, the military, and then their partners in the private sector or the voluntary sector play in disaster aid. One of the things that shifts over time, though, is that the government in the early 20th century relied much more heavily on especially the American Red Cross, but other non-governmental voluntary organizations as well. To conduct and carry out a lot of aid operations, mostly on its behalf. They did so in cooperation with these groups and assisted them in a lot of ways. But much of the funding, much of the sort of drive for all of this was coming through the American Red Cross and other agencies. Over time, that starts to shift. And really, especially as you get into the post-World War II period, the U.S. government starts to play more and more of a central role in the funding, the delivery, the distribution of disaster aid. And so that's kind of one of the arcs, the narrative arcs that I'm tracing in the book, is how and why the government starts to play a more official role rather than this sort of ad hoc, informal role that it did early in the 20th century. So I think that's one of the most important ways that it does change, is just how the U.S. government itself and the military come to play a more central role. The other thing that changes a lot is the rise of international organizations that are involved in disaster aid. So I mentioned already the League of Red Cross Societies, which is still in existence today. It's been renamed the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies. But over time, especially since World War II, a lot of other international organizations through UN agencies, so intergovernmental agencies, as well as international non-governmental organizations, have played more and more of a role in disaster aid globally. And that's really shaped the dynamics on the ground and changed the ways, changed who is being involved in disaster aid, who is not, who are the humanitarian actors. Has the field has broadened quite a lot since the early 20th century.
Can you discuss any instances where the provision of humanitarian aid directly influenced the larger diplomatic relations between the U.S. and other nations?
Yes, in many of the instances I talk about in the book, certainly we see at least a short-term effect. A lot of the ways that there's this sort of short-term impact after disasters happen, after aid is carried out, there's a lot of sort of public displays of thanks from leaders, and then the sort of the diplomacy associated with giving and receiving aid is this it's a very it shapes diplomatic relations in ways that we often don't they're sort of it's informal it's unacknowledged protocol, I suppose, is one way to think about it. But in other cases, and I have a few case studies in the book that are more sort of in depth and looking at specific disasters, chapter level studies. So one of the most important, I think, in the book was in 1923. There was a major earthquake in Japan that devastated especially the cities of Yokohama and Tokyo. It's called the Great Kanto Earthquake. But 1923 was this really interesting moment in U.S.-Japanese relations. It's in the aftermath of World War I, in a few years after the Washington Naval Conference. It's at a moment when U.S.-Japanese relations are not necessarily at a great place. In large part, this is the period, too, when the U.S. Congress is considering banning Japanese immigration to the United States. There's a lot of anti-Japanese sentiment within the U.S. And so this earthquake comes in September 1923, in this really pivotal moment of U.S. in the history of U.S.-Japanese relations. And for a short time, as I talk about in the book, the sort of massive outpouring of U.S. aid does seem to have a positive effect on U.S. foreign relations or U.S. relations with Japan. But that gives way fairly quickly as well. It's part of the story that I tell in that chapter is that these efforts to cultivate goodwill are quickly undermined by you know, efforts to, again, to ban Japanese immigration to the United States and other sort of perceived affronts to Japanese sovereignty and then sort of honor as well. So it becomes this kind of moment, this sort of the promises and limitations, I think, of disaster aid as diplomacy, if we think about it in relation to what else is going on in U.S.-Japanese relations. But there's other examples like that in the book, and I have a case study of U.S. aid to Italy in the early 20th century, for instance, that we see kind of similar dynamics in terms of relations between the two countries and questions of immigration. All of this kind of plays a role as well there. Reading the book, I think you'll see a lot of different places where. Where disaster aid really does shape diplomacy, at least for a short time, if not permanently.
What governmental agencies or departments have played pivotal roles in shaping U.S. foreign disaster assistance policies, and how have these policies also evolved?
So in the early 20th century, especially, since the early 20th century, and honestly since the 19th century, but especially since the early 20th century, the State Department and the staff of U.S. diplomatic and consular missions play a really major role in deciding which disasters merit a response. There's a lot of kind of language, is this in the U.S. national interest to provide aid? And if so, what types of aid should the U.S. government provide? Should the U.S. military provide? So the State Department and its kind of agents on the ground play a really important role in making those decisions about whether to make offers of aid or not. And this increases over time. So as early as the early 20th century, you see these kind of patterns emerging. But especially after World War II, the State Department is playing a kind of central role. After World War II, you also start to see the formation of permanent U.S. foreign aid agencies. USAID is created in 1961, and this is the organization that is still in existence today. But before USAID, there were several precursors throughout the 40s and 50s, organizations like the Foreign Operations Administration, the International Cooperation Administration. These were both in the 1950s. And they, too, played a really important role. Their development missions, for instance, the personnel of them often became involved in disaster relief and recovery operations. So those sort of foreign assistance organizations play a pivotal role, too. And then finally, the U.S. military. When I started this project, the U.S. military today in the 21st century plays a major role in U.S. international disaster aid efforts. And I didn't realize that this would have such a long history. I thought it would be a sort of later 20th century phenomenon or development. But in fact, as I started researching, I found the military all over the place. Often when U.S. troops or ships, sort of Navy ships and sailors were stationed nearby when a disaster happened, they were dispatched to the scene to provide assistance. So as early as the first decades of the 20th century, you start to see the military, especially the Navy and the Marines, playing a major role in disaster relief operations. They're usually doing so at the State Department's request. So it's kind of the State Department requests military assistance, and then the Departments of War and the Navy, later the Departments of Defense, respond to those requests. But you have these various branches of the U.S. government, the State Department, the Foreign Service Organizations, Foreign Assistance Organizations, and the military all involved pretty deeply throughout the 20th century.
In your view, are there particular turning points or milestones in your history of U.S. foreign disaster assistance that significantly impacted diplomatic strategies?
So one of the book I wrote is divided into three parts, and it the parts kind of break up between the First and Second World Wars. So the first part is essentially the turn of the 20th century up through the eve of U.S. entry into the First World War in 1916. The second part is sort of from U.S. entry into the war in 1917 through the ends and the aftermath of World War II in 1947. And then the third part takes us up through the creation of USAID in 1961 and its aftermath into the 60s and 70s. So I mentioned the wars because many histories of U.S. foreign relations focus on war, and this is not a book about war. It's a book about disasters. But one of the things that I'm arguing is that the ways that the U.S. state changed, so the sort of expansion of the U.S. government, the expansion of the military during both conflicts, especially though during the Second World War, really changed how the United States. Its global footprint, its capabilities, its reach. These affect not only war making and diplomacy making, but the United States' role as a humanitarian power as well. So both wars are really important turning points, especially the Second World War for various reasons. The creation of different aid agencies is also important. I kind of mentioned earlier USAID and its precursors. At the end of the book, though, I also examine the creation in 1964 of what came to be called the Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance. So before this time, the U.S. government had been providing all this aid, but it hadn't had a single sort of bureau or department that was devoted to providing aid. So its creation in 1964 was a really important turning point in sort of formalizing the U.S. government's role in foreign disaster assistance. I also look at changes to the Foreign Assistance Act, the legislation that governs foreign assistance. There's a major amendment added in 1975. For the first time, international disaster assistance is added as a specific category to the Foreign Assistance Act. So this marks a really major turning point as well. Going back in time, the book begins in the early 20th century because it's really in this period, especially during Teddy Roosevelt's presidency, that all of a sudden the U.S. government starts to provide aid to all of these disasters in other places. There were sort of moments in the 19th century, sort of here and there, where the government provided at least little bits of aid to other nations hit by disaster. But it really is in the early 20th century, the first decades of the 20th century, that you start to see this becoming a common and really routine element of U.S. foreign relations. So starting there at the kind of dawn of the 20th century is the first turning point of the book, and then the others that follow.
Can you share examples from the book that illustrate the challenges the United States has had or faced in implementing some of their foreign disaster aid?
Some of the challenges, I think, are that disasters, as much as you try to plan for them, are in a lot of ways unplannable. They're these contingent events. You might know that a place is at risk for an earthquake or a hurricane, but no one really knows exactly when that will happen, at what date it will strike. And so this sort of contingent nature of these events, I think, makes them both, really challenging for U.S. foreign policymakers to kind of figure out how to plan for. So this is a sort of overarching theme. And as you get into the late 50s and early 60s, there's a lot more effort in trying to plan for the unplannable or trying to plan for these contingent events. So I think that that's one of the ways that you sort of see this playing out. But on the ground, in a lot of cases, you have diplomats and sort of foreign aid organizations who have asked or requested certain types of aid, and all of a sudden it's too much or too little of one kind. In some cases, they found that they had more money than they knew what to do with, which it's a pretty, you know, it's not the worst problem to have. But it led them to try to figure out, well, what can we do with this extra money? And sometimes they took on these sort of interesting experimental programs. In the case of Italy, for example, in the early 20th century, they had far more donations than they could imagine. They ended up building things like an orphanage, a hotel, in order to kind of spur tourism again. So these really kind of interesting moments of trying to figure out what to do with this excess funding. In a lot of cases, probably most cases, there's not enough funding to really resolve the issues that are at hand. So there's also a kind of lot of debates about where should aid go, who should be assisted, how do you kind of who should be prioritized in the provision and distribution of aid. So these are cases like that too, and quite a lot of disaster scenarios.
Are there key figures or individuals who you want to mention here for the New Books Network who left a lasting mark on the trajectory of U.S. foreign disaster assistance?
It's funny researching a book like this, you come across a lot of people who you get to know very well through their archives and who probably most people have never heard of. So in my book, there are a few people. There was a man named Ernest Bicknell, who was a leader in the early 20th century. I actually wrote about him a lot in my first book. He was a Red Cross, American Red Cross sort of director and official. He was followed later by a man named Ernest Swift, who played a really major role in disaster aid. And another American Red Cross official named Sam Krakow, who's just all over the archives for 20 years. You start to feel like you get to know these people personally. You're reading so much of their writings and seeing where they're going and traveling the world. So these sort of people who would otherwise not really enter the historical record really play this major role throughout the 20th century in shaping U.S. foreign disaster aid. The final one who had made a little bit more of an impression, I guess, on the public was a guy named Stephen Tripp. Stephen Tripp was the first, he was appointed the first coordinator of U.S. foreign disaster assistance for the U.S. government in 1964. He was sort of so well known at the time that Time magazine did a story on him, as did Reader's Digest. They called him America's Mr. Catastrophe. So Steve Tripp was this kind of interesting person. I was actually able to interview his daughter and learn a little bit about his history, but he had been a Marine. He worked for the Interior Department, and then he was sort of appointed as the first person to coordinate U.S. disaster assistance. So I tell all of these guys' stories a little bit in different ways in the book, but they're interesting characters nonetheless. The other, in researching this book, I always, whenever I'm talking to other historians of humanitarianism, I'm always very interested in the role that Herbert Hoover plays in disaster aid. And in this book, it's sort of no exception. Hoover's really involved in shaping ideas about U.S. foreign disaster assistance from the First World War all the way through his presidency and then beyond. So Herbert Hoover plays he occupies a lot of space in my book in ways that if you told me, 20 years ago that I'd write this much about Herbert Hoover, I would have been surprised. But he keeps finding his way into the stuff I research. So.
Are there any reviews that either critique your work, and are there cases that have been met with resistance or criticism about foreign disaster assistance?
I'm sure there will be reviews critiquing my work, but since the book just came out, I haven't had to have too many of them. So, tune back in later. As for critiques of foreign disaster assistance itself, absolutely. And I mean, I tell a critical story myself. I mean, I look for moments of both. I think writing about humanitarian aid is interesting because there's certainly a lot of positive moments to highlight, but also places to critique, to criticize, to think about ways that we might do this better. There's a long history of, there's a lot to figure out ways that we can do humanitarian aid better. And I think studying history helps us think through that. In terms of the book itself, though, within my research, there were a number of cases where the recipients of U.S. foreign aid themselves even became critics. One case that I remember really it really struck me, and I write about it a bit in the book. In the 1930s, the early 1930s, there was major flooding in China in 1931. And the U.S. government ended up selling surplus commodities to China at a kind of fairly low cost as food aid. So this becomes a very common way of providing disaster assistance and other humanitarian assistance later in the 20th century. But this idea of selling surplus agricultural commodities to China as humanitarian aid, but also as a way to help U.S. farmers was tested in this moment in 1931. This provoked, though, a lot of some backlash from people who were affected. There was this really poignant petition by a group of farmers in several different Chinese provinces who wrote to the U.S. Ambassador and said, you know, this attempt to provide us aid, while we appreciate, you know, the gesture, what you've actually done is undermined our ability to recover our own agriculture. You've kind of flooded this area with food. We can't recover our own agriculture. We can't sell what we need to recover ourselves. So these sort of unintended consequences of U.S. giving without asking recipients what they need or want. This is just one example, but you see this kind of pattern occurring in a lot of places. Throughout the 20th century. So there are certainly critiques, and there are others as well. There are critiques of U.S. foreign aid being simply a tool of propaganda and diplomacy. These are really deployed in a lot of places, and this, especially as the Cold War sets in. There's a lot of debates about what, you know, is aid really genuine, or is it just simply, you know, a tool of public diplomacy that you see kind of coming out from various corners, criticizing aid as well. So, I talk about a lot of these moments in the book too. So,
in what ways does catastrophic diplomacy consider the global perception of U.S. foreign disaster assistance, and how has that perception changed over time?
That's a good question. So, you know, I think the book itself doesn't look at a sort of, you know, a single global perspective, but sort of tells this international global story through a lot of different local perspectives. So I'm looking at case studies of a lot of different disasters and disaster responses in many different countries, many different regions. So I think you get different voices of people. I've mentioned Italy and Japan and China and Chile, and so these and many other different countries as well. So I'm kind of giving the reader voices of people at different moments and in different regions who were shaped and affected by disaster. In terms of kind of the role, you know, a sort of a global response, a sort of international response, there's, I think, less of that. But it's certainly something I'm interested in, how kind of international agencies and organizations respond to, you know, to these operations. Wherever possible, I try to kind of tried in the research to find voices and perspectives of, you know, of both the recipients of aid, but also kind of outside observers who, you know, so British officials, for instance, who were also involved in aid operations. What were they saying about the Americans who were on the ground? Swiss or other European Red Cross leaders who were kind of watching the American Red Cross. What were they saying about the assistance that was given? And then, of course, what were aid recipients themselves kind of saying, and how were they responding? So in all of these ways, I think we get sort of different snippets of how different people and from different countries were thinking about U.S. aid, but not a sort of singular a holistic global narrative, if that makes sense.
Can you say the same thing about public opinion?
So do you mean like American public opinion or what do you think? I mean, yeah.
Yes. Okay. American.
Yeah. So American public opinion is interesting. You know, I think in a lot of cases, at least when the headlines are kind of calling attention to a disaster and sort of sudden destruction, disasters in a lot of ways tend to be initially to create less, there's sort of more of a willingness and a bipartisan willingness almost to give to sort of people who are perceived for better, for worse, as kind of worthy of assistance. So there's this kind of outpouring of aid that often follows an immediate disaster. But then that shifts in different ways as you start to see, you know, over time, like as the kind of immediate event passes, growing criticisms of, too much aid from some corners, too little aid from other corners. We should be doing more to focus on domestic problems. So a lot of the things that you hear in response to debates over foreign assistance today in the 21st century certainly rang out throughout the 20th century as well. These questions about, what should, where should American tax dollars be spent? How should they best be directed? Is providing aid to survivors of international disasters in the interests of the United States? And this is a term that they often use. Is it in the U.S. national interests to provide international aid? And so all of this is really, plays out in public opinion. Some of the most interesting research that I had were people writing to the State Department or to various presidential administrations expressing their opinion. So Americans used to write lots of letters to their government officials expressing all sorts of opinions about whether the aid was good or was bad or was worthwhile or was too much or was not enough. So there were certainly a lot of those voices as well.
What about the ethical considerations and dilemmas associated with providing foreign disaster assistance?
There are many of them. So no, and I think I mentioned already the story about providing surplus commodities and how sort of unintended consequences of undermining local agriculture and flooding sort of markets with aid. That's, I think, one of the examples. But throughout the book, I'm looking at a lot of individual actors on the ground, some of whom were certainly acting with the best of intentions, and I think I would say doing real good, and others who were not. There were a lot of people involved in foreign aid who looked down on and sort of patronized or even criticized the recipients of their assistance. Certainly, there's a lot of racial animosity in a lot of cases as well. That certainly raises questions about, what is, how does humanitarian aid work and how does it kind of reflect American power? So I think those kind of go into the ethical dilemmas surrounding aid. But I think, at the most basic level, so much of this aid is kind of imposed, and this is certainly throughout the 20th century, kind of decisions made in Washington about, what is needed, whose interests are going to be served, without really taking into account the needs, the desires, the wants, of people on the ground. So I think a kind of a more ethical and efficacious foreign assistance takes those perspectives into account. And there are certainly examples of that as well throughout the book, but unfortunately, more of the story is about the kind of power dynamics involved.
Are there examples, which I'm sure there are, but can you provide examples of collaboration or tensions with other nations specifically that you found in your research?
Yeah. So there's a couple I could talk about. One of the earliest and kind of most blatant examples of these, in 1907, there was an earthquake in Kingston, Jamaica, which was at that point a British colony. The United States responded. They sent a couple of Navy ships with aid to the region from U.S. territories in Puerto Rico and Guantanamo. And they arrived, and basically due to some miscommunications, the commander of these ships landed American troops ashore in Jamaica, and they began taking part in aid efforts, but also in policing efforts. Essentially, the governor had not given his permission, and it led to this enormous just diplomatic kerfuffle over all of this. It led to several months of kind of efforts to smooth this out between Washington and then the Roosevelt administration, their counterparts in Great Britain. And so this was an important example of kind of getting consent and permission before landing troops in another country to provide aid. Throughout the Cold War era, though, there's a lot more examples of this. In China, for instance, after 1949, the U.S. stopped providing disaster assistance to China following the Communist Revolution. But there were moments where U.S. officials were considering whether they could provide aid nonetheless, essentially as a form of propaganda, public diplomacy. They talked about flying over Chinese airspace without authorization and then landing aid without permission. So this was certainly, this was decided against, but this kind of question about, you know, should humanitarian aid, can it trump a nation's sovereignty? How should that, what role should that play, was coming up there. There was a similar case in Cuba in 1963. There was a major hurricane that hit Cuba in 1963. And the U.S. government desperately wanted to provide aid to Cuba, essentially to show Cuban people that the United States cared about them. I mean, this was the language that the State Department, the National Security Council were using. And this is, of course, right after, a couple years after the Cuban Revolution. The Cuban Red Cross refuses American offers of aid, essentially saying, you know, we find it hypocritical that you've been trying to destroy our government for the past 4 years, and all of a sudden now you want to deliver humanitarian assistance. They go on to accept aid from other nations, including the Soviet Union, but also other U.S. NATO allies. But it's this really kind of moment of controversy over, you know, whether, you know, what are the purposes of aid? Why is the U.S. so desperate to kind of give aid to these countries, and then what happens when those countries refuse? So I think those raise some really interesting questions about the kind of politics and controversy surrounding assistance.
Okay, what about non-governmental organizations or NGOs and international partnerships in execution of U.S. foreign disaster assistance?
Yeah, so they play a major role is the short answer. One of the things that is, so the book focuses especially on the American Red Cross, because for the early, for the first half of the 20th century, and even well after the Second World War, the American Red Cross was essentially the U.S. government's preferred partner in foreign disaster assistance. Historian Emily Rosenberg many years ago famously called the Red Cross a chosen instrument of the U.S. government, but essentially this idea that the Red Cross is the humanitarian auxiliary of the U.S. government at a time when the government itself doesn't have, you know, sort of the infrastructure, the agencies to carry out foreign aid by itself. So the American Red Cross plays this role. The American Red Cross, though, is not a totally non-governmental organization. It occupies this really interesting role in U.S. governance. It is the American Red Cross under both the Geneva Conventions as well as a congressional charter that it was granted in 1900 and then again in 1905, operates in this very different way from other you know, sort of non-governmental organizations. It's probably better to call it, especially in the early 20th century, a quasi-governmental organization. The American Red Cross's headquarters initially, or in the early 20th century, it was housed in the same building as the Department of the State War and Navy Department building. So basically the Red Cross and its leaders were right down the hall from State Department officials, Department of War officials, Department of Navy officials, and they're really talking in very close communication. They have access to all sorts of government resources. The government sort of, you know, negotiates deals on the Red Cross's behalf with other governments. So there's this really kind of interesting relationship that they share that kind of makes it, you know, again, quasi-governmental rather than non-governmental. But the Red Cross plays a really major role in providing a lot of the funding, a lot of the mobilization for U.S. disaster assistance operations, carrying out a lot of them, in some cases sending its personnel to these places to work with both local and U.S. government officials. So its role is really central in ways that I talk about in the book. After World War II, this situation changes a bit. The U.S. government starts to partner with a lot of other non-governmental organizations, so both faith-based and secular organizations, groups like Catholic Relief Services, Church World Service, CARE. All of them become increasingly prominent in U.S. foreign disaster aid as well. These organizations are non-governmental, but like the Red Cross, they establish these connections with the U.S. government. There's a committee that is created that these organizations have to apply to, and if they're accepted, They get access to things like surplus agricultural commodities. They get access to free shipping of humanitarian supplies thanks to congressional funding patterns. So they benefit quite a lot from the kind of relationship that they form with the U.S. government. And the U.S. government, in turn, benefits from having these organizations that are, you know, in communication with it, that are kind of carrying out activities that serve U.S. interests. And so I talk a lot in the book about the relationship between these, you know, state and ostensibly non-state actors, and really make the argument that they're a lot more related than we often think. Their relationship is not, you know, state and non-state as these two separate entities, but they actually work very closely together to carry out U.S. foreign assistance operations.
What implications does the book suggest for policymakers and diplomats who want to enhance the efficacy of foreign disaster assistance, if you haven't addressed this already?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, one of the things that I want to, the book really stops in the 1970s. So it's been 50 years, or give or take, since the last sort of scene in the book. And I don't think, you know, the world in 2023 is very different from the world in the mid-70s. So we can't sort of make these direct parallels. But I would like to hope that a policymaker or an aid worker, you know, kind of reading this book and thinking about this history, would see both the good and the bad, as the warts and all version of this history, right? There are moments where, again, there are people who are acting with good intentions and doing good and then taking into account the perspectives and the needs of disaster survivors. But there are a lot of others who are racist or nationalistic or have cultural chauvinism or who kind of judge people on the basis of class, who don't listen to the needs, the desires of the people they're supposed to be helping. So I think kind of reading these examples and hopefully sort of, you know, learning from taking the good ones as models and perhaps leaving behind some of the less savory examples would be good for foreign aid more generally. So I think that's what I hope, is that by reading this history and kind of thinking about both the positive and the negative aspects of this history can hopefully inform the ways that people think about foreign disaster aid today.
How might the historical analysis in catastrophic diplomacy inform our understanding of current global challenges?
So, you know, as I said, it's a different world 50 years later, especially as we deal with the major effects of climate change in the 21st century. However, I think some of the, you know, some of the lessons remain salient, right? You know, how do you ensure that aid is, you know, as apolitical as possible, right? That you're kind of not, that you're providing aid out of authentic humanitarian motivations more so than political ones, I think is an important one, whether we're talking about the 20th or the 21st century. That would kind of shape the ways that people think about, you know, aid and its use in the world.
Looking ahead, what do you see as a potential trend or challenge that the U.S. Might face when it comes to their disaster assistance?
Well, I think throughout the 20th century and certainly today, there's ongoing efforts to ensure that, you know, humanitarian assistance is such a minuscule part, relatively speaking, of the U.S. federal budget. There's always sort of pushes for more aid, more support, more congressional funding, and I think that, you know, that is going to continue to be a reality, especially, you know, certainly some politicians are calling for shrinking the State Department and shrinking foreign assistance agencies and budgets, and that's going to make it all the more challenging for people to try to conduct good and meaningful and effective humanitarian work in the world. So I think that that's, you know, the sort of debates over, you know, how much federal funding is there for these efforts are going to be important. I think thinking about the ways that the United States government is involved with the international community and international organizations is also going to be an important trend. Certainly, we've seen a lot of back and forth in recent years, I think, between those who want the United States to play a more international role, to be involved in multinational organizations and cooperative sort of movements. And those who want to focus on the United States first, right? Who want to focus on national problems, who want to take a more unilateral approach to foreign affairs. I think if this book teaches us anything, it's that the importance of working at a more multinational kind of cooperative level. Things like rising climate change, rising seas, destructive storms, flooding. These don't just affect a single nation. Natural hazards don't care about national borders. So it's really imperative, I think, to take a global approach to these problems rather than simply trying to take a national one, if possible.
What have you got planned for your future? And do you have any final thoughts for the New Books Network audience?
So I am now writing a book. I'm writing a short history of international humanitarianism. So it's going to be a very short sort of overview. So I'm doing moving beyond just U.S. foreign disaster aid and really looking at international humanitarianism as a more global story. So that's what I'm working on at the moment. Not entirely sure what the next monograph project is going to be. I'm kind of experimenting with different things, but certainly it will involve humanitarian aid and disasters in some ways. Otherwise, as I mentioned earlier, I just moved to Louisiana State University. So I just finished my first semester here, and it's been absolutely delightful. And so I'm really looking forward to continuing to get to know students and then kind of teach classes here at LSU. So it's been great. And certainly there's a lot of folks here who think about disasters, the environment in different ways. Louisiana is not immune to a lot of the challenges that I talk about in my book in terms of hurricanes, obviously, but other hazards. So kind of thinking about the local impacts of some of the international stories I tell, I think will continue to be interesting to me as both a scholar and a teacher in the years to come. In terms of last things for the New Books Network, I guess my final thought is that, studying this history is important, I think, to get us thinking about ways that we're going to deal with the environmental challenges and the global environmental challenges of the 21st century. Hopefully the history and studying and reading about this history can help us think about how to have disaster aid that's less paternalistic, less politicized, more efficacious, and more ethical than it often was in the past. And I think that's my hope, is that by studying this history, we can we can learn from what didn't work out so well and figure out how to do it better for the benefit of everybody. And that's the hope with humanitarian history, I think.
You listened to an original podcast recording of the New Books Network and your host, Nathan Moore. Our audience can thank Julia F. Irwin for discussing her new book, Catastrophic Diplomacy, U.S. Foreign Disaster Assistance in the American Century, from the University of North Carolina Press. Subscribe to get more episodes like this one from the New Books Network.